Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 40 years ago this morning, 9:32 a.m. Florida time, July 16th, 1969, Apollo 11 took off from the Kennedy Space Center with its three-man crew, headed for Earth's first contact with the moon. 248,000 miles and 4 days later, with millions glued to their televisions, Neil Armstrong took the first steps on the dusty lunar surface. It was beyond thrilling. 40 years on, the question is, what next? There's a rich debate among others over whether the next big American push in manned space exploration should be back to the moon or straight on to Mars. China and Russia are already moving, planning. This hour On Point, Moon versus Mars and the next big manned push into space. You can join the conversation. What do you say? Moon, Mars, lunar return, red planet colonies, none of the above? Where would you aim the next rocket? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to hear from advocates for Moon, advocate for Mars. But first, let's go back to that amazing time 40 years ago. Here's tape of the historic launch to the moon, July 16, 1969. CBS's Walter Cronkite narrates. Sit back and just listen, or remember if you heard it then, as the rockets rumble and mission control counts down.
Ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running.
Somebody must be leaving town.
Building shaking. We're getting that buffeting we've become used to. What a moment. Man on the way to the moon.
And there's the takeoff 40 years ago. This morning we were wrapped, we were riveted. And it got better. 4 days later, January 20th, 1969, Apollo 11's lunar lander, the Eagle, made contact with the moon for the first time. Here's Neil Armstrong radioing back to Mission Control in Houston.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
And with Walter Cronkite narrating, Neil Armstrong descended the Eagle stairs onto the moon's surface. Viewers around the world saw the first shaky images of history being made.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lamb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very... very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine.
Boy, look at those pictures.
Wow.
It's a little shadowy, but he said he expected that in the shadow of the lunar module. Armstrong is on the moon.
Now,
Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon. On this July 20th, 1969.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It was beyond thrilling. It was epical. Here we are 40 years later, and we're talking today about Moon versus Mars and where the United States should aim its next big manned exploration effort. We will hear in a few minutes from one of the last men, astronauts, to walk on the moon. But joining me first from Denver, Colorado, is Robert Zubrin. He is president of the aerospace company Pioneer Astronautics and a former aerospace engineer for Lockheed Martin. He's the author of The Case for Mars, The Plan to Settle the Red Planet and Why We Must, and his latest book, How to Live on Mars, a trusty guidebook to surviving and thriving on the red planet. Robert Zubrin, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
And with us today from Houston, Texas, is David Kring. He is senior staff scientist for NASA's Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. He's former director of the NASA Space Imagery Center. David, glad to have you here.
Thank you very much.
You know, Robert Zubrin, I imagine you watched that moonshot takeoff 40 years ago today and that landing. When you listen back to that, I don't know if you still feel the chills up and down your spine. I certainly do. It makes the moon look like a pretty exciting place to go, but you're not interested in going back. Why not? Why Mars?
Well, the moon was a great challenge for us in the 1960s. It really showed the world, and we showed ourselves that we could do anything we set our minds to it. But for NASA today to set as its great challenge repeating an accomplishment it did a half century before, that is, returning to the moon by 2019, 50 years after we were there the first time, there's an element of farce to that. NASA was not set up as a nostalgia agency. It was set up as a pioneering agency.
But people have talked about stair steps here, people including former President George W. Bush. Here he was at NASA headquarters in 2004 announcing this initiative for NASA to go back to the moon, then later to Mars.
The moon is a logical step toward further progress and achievement. With the experience and knowledge gained on the moon, we will then be ready to take the next steps of space exploration, human missions to Mars, and to worlds beyond.
George W. Bush, January 14th, 2004. David Kring in Houston, Texas. I don't imagine you would say don't go to Mars, but you're in the let's go back to the moon first camp. Why?
Well, we spent a small amount of time on the lunar surface, and it was extraordinarily exciting, but there is so much to be learned if we go back. To put it in another perspective, if one strolled around the Boston Gardens for an afternoon, one wouldn't want to conclude that they now understand the Earth perfectly. And I would argue that the Apollo missions, as extraordinarily successful as they are, simply open the door a crack into what we can learn by going back to the moon. And moreover, it's not just about going back to the moon. It is about learning about the origin of the moon, the origin of the Earth-Moon system, and the development of the entire solar system. The clues to all of those very important issues can be unraveled on our nearest neighbor.
And maybe more than that, I'm looking here at a fascinating article. This is from the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. And it shows a plan, I don't know if this has ever gained traction, but for lunar solar power, kind of using the moon as a gigantic photovoltaic solar energy collector that would then be beamed by microwave, I guess, down to the Earth. Could the moon service the Earth in that way, David Kring?
That's one of the technological initiatives that has been discussed, but whether it will work or will not work, it does illustrate the principle that simply by thinking about going to the moon and developing the hardware to go back to the moon and figuring out what is needed to operate on the moon, we are creating technological inspiration that not only will make us successful in going back to the moon, but will serve to drive technological development right here on Earth.
Robert Zubrin, I'm looking at headlines here. The first China to send Mars probe satellite in October of this year. Another here out of Moscow, where they're already practicing to travel to and live on Mars. Just a couple of days ago, where a Russian, German, and soldier and French airline pilot came out of 105 days locked in a series of sealed tubes practicing that, and they're about to go into a 520-day isolation experiment revving up for Mars. Why would you skip a return to the moon? I mean, wouldn't the moon have value getting back there, getting the rust out of our systems? If we're going to do manned exploration, you know, sort of shake out the dust on the moon before we head on up to the red planet?
Well, the Mars Society, which is a nonprofit that I lead, currently has a crew in a simulated Mars habitat. 900 miles from the North Pole doing a practice Mars mission in the field.
Are these Americans or who's that?
These are actually Americans. Mm-hmm. Two of them are NASA personnel. The others are geologists and engineers from elsewhere. We've also had international crews up there. But we can practice for Mars in places like the Arctic and Antarctic for 1/1,000th or 1/100,000th the cost that we could do on the moon. The real issue is this. We got to the moon in 8 years after Kennedy's speech because he committed us to doing that. He didn't say, well, you know, I think we should someday go somewhere in space and let me know when you're ready. He said, this is the goal. This is the time frame. Let's do it. Unless you commit to Mars in that way, you will never get there. And with all due respect to, you know, Dr. Bush and his speech, you know, what Bush did was a farcical replay of Kennedy. He said, return to the moon by 2020, which was 16 years after the 2004 date when he gave that speech. It only took 8 years for us to get there the first time, starting in an era before push-button telephones had been invented.
We're going to learn a lot in this hour, including on exactly that front. Going out of this segment, let's listen to President John F. Kennedy and just exactly what you're talking about there. His call to action on the moon. Here he is, September 12, 1962, at Rice University, Houston, told America about his intentions for space.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, 40 years after the first moon launch. Exactly 40 years ago today, we're talking about moon versus Mars and where the United States might, should aim its next big manned exploration effort, which the U.S. should aim to maybe colonize. Of course, 40 years ago, it was all about the moon. While standing on the surface of the moon, Neil Armstrong and his colleague in NASA, Buzz Aldrin, received a very long-distance telephone call from then-President Richard Nixon.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made. I just can't tell you how proud we all are of what you did. For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. And for people all over the world, I am sure they too join with Americans in recognizing what an immense feat this is.
Richard Nixon, on the phone to the moon. We've been joined from Denver by Robert Zubrin. He's president of the Pioneer Astronautics. He says, let's go to Mars. David Kring is with us from Houston, Texas, senior staff scientist at NASA's Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. Says, moon first, please. I want to invite into our conversation right now from Albuquerque, New Mexico, Harrison Jack Schmidt, former United States Senator from New Mexico, current chair of the NASA Advisory Council. He was a crew member as an astronaut on the 1972 Apollo lunar mission, the last manned mission to the moon, one of the last people on Earth to have walked on the moon. Senator Jack Schmidt, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Which do you say, sir? Should we go manned into space again? And if we do, moon or Mars?
Well, the fastest way to get to Mars is by way of the moon, in my opinion.
Because?
We don't know how to land on Mars yet, for one thing. Secondly, we need to learn again, unfortunately again, how to operate in deep space. And there's another generation or two that are going to have to learn what some of us learned the hard way back in the 60s. And in addition, the moon, while we figure out how to land on Mars, the moon development on the moon will provide the resources at significantly lower costs that are necessary in order to make that trip and to do useful things on Mars.
Now, what do you mean by that, the resources on the moon would be provided
for
Mars?
Once you are established on the moon, you have the oxygen, water, and other consumables available at in a 1/6 gravity well rather than in a one-gravity well, as we now have to use to get those resources into space. And so that is one, I think, very significant advantage of having a strong presence on the moon at the same time that you're preparing to go to Mars. The other thing is that if we are smart, we will develop the energy resources of the moon for use here on Earth. That's helium-3 fusion power, helium-3 being a resource on the moon as well. And the helium-3 fusion also provides us with the a nearly ideal technology for interplanetary propulsion.
Is that a kind of nuclear fuel that would be then?
It is a type of nuclear fuel. It's a fusion of atoms rather than the breaking up or fission of atoms, as we do now to produce power. And helium-3 is an ideal fuel for doing that because there's no residual radioactivity in its use.
Jack Schmidt, when you last stood on the moon in 1972 in your astronaut boots, did you ever imagine it might one day be 2009 and no one would have been back there?
Well, we knew, of course, that Apollo 17 was the last of the Apollo series. I will have to admit, though, I didn't think it. We would wait over 50 years before we were back on the moon, and have this element of doubt that still exists of whether the United States is going to be a player in space.
Well, and let me ask you about that. We're in the midst of a terrible economic recession, some have said depression, worst in many decades. Does space exploration, manned space exploration, make sense with all the challenges we've got right here on Earth right now?
Of course it does. We have many challenges we have to deal with, and we have to deal with them simultaneously. One of those challenges is to make sure that the forces of liberty are dominant and certainly competitive in space and deep space. If non-democratic regimes become dominant in space, then liberty will be at serious risk here on Earth. And from a strategic point of view, I don't think we have a choice. From an economic point of view, it is a minuscule expense in order to get great benefits.
Former astronaut, one of the last humans to stand on Earth in the 1972 Apollo 17 lunar mission, Harrison Jack Schmidt. Senator Schmidt, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, and my best to your other participants in this conversation.
Thank you so much. Robert Zubrin, you hear there from one of the last guys to stand on the moon, who says that's where we should go. It would be a great launching pad for the rest. We have to learn how to land again. We've got to learn deep space again. You can find fuel there for deep space. What do you say?
Well, there are some things that Jack said that I agree with and some that I disagree with. Let me quickly go through the ones that I disagree with, but then I want to emphasize the point that I strongly agree with. Mm-hmm. You're not going to learn how to land on Mars by going to the moon. The moon has no atmosphere. When you land on Mars, you use aeroshells and parachutes. You don't use them on the moon. As far as making fuel on the moon to go to Mars, that makes no sense. The amount of rocket propulsion needed to go from Earth orbit to the surface of the moon is actually greater than that needed to go from the low Earth orbit to the surface of Mars. So even if we had a lunar base right now that was making rocket fuel and giving it away for free to anyone who would come by, it still would not make sense to go to the moon in order to go to Mars. Now, the point that he said that I strongly do agree with is his final comments bearing on, can we do an ambitious program like this in a time of crisis? We certainly can and should. I mean, when Kennedy gave that speech that you played a few minutes mm-hmm. ago, the United States was in a recession and was 1 month away from a nuclear war with the Soviet Union.
The threat of.
Yes. And we were facing 10,000 Soviet nuclear warheads aimed at us and 150 Warsaw Pact divisions on the Elbe in Germany ready to pour across into Western Europe. And the stock market had fallen 30% in September 1962. And yet Kennedy said, we choose to go to the moon. We choose to do these things because they are not because they are easy, because they're hard, because we are a nation that can take on challenges. And guess what? The Apollo program spurred the United States out of recession. From a recession, we went into 5 and 6% rates of economic growth in this country in the 1960s. And not only that, as a result of the Apollo program, we doubled the number of science graduates in this country at every level, high school, college, PhD. And You know, that has benefited us ever since. The 40-year-old technological entrepreneurs who created the computer revolution in the 1990s were the 12-year-old little boy scientists of the 1960s who were excited about the challenge of science as the great adventure. If we had a Humans to Mars program today, we would invite millions of not just little boys but little girls, because science is now open both to men and women in this country in a way that was not the case in the 1960s. We would get millions of scientists, engineers, doctors, medical researchers, inventors, technological entrepreneurs that would be coming up with new medical cures, inventing inventions that create new industries, adding to our national defense. It's the intellectual capital of a nation that is the basis of the strength of a nation in both peace and war.
And if we don't, you say, I think we'll be losing the space race, if that's what you want to call it, in a matter of a few years, a handful of years.
Well, we'll be falling behind, you know. I mean, but we're falling behind in all kinds of ways. The real issue here is who we are. Are we still a nation of pioneers? Are we still a nation whose great deeds will be celebrated in newspapers or in space museums?
Robert Zubin, okay, stand by. I want to come to David Kring on the moon. I want to get some listeners in here right away as well. First to Underhill, mm-hmm. Vermont, and Pat. Pat, what do you say? Moon, Mars, neither?
Oh, Mars, Mars, Mars.
Why?
I think we need to... Because I think when we said we were going to the moon, we went to the moon. We didn't say we were going to circumnavigate the Earth a few times and maybe then we'd go to the moon. We said we're going to go to the moon. And we did the interim steps needed to get there. And I think we need to focus on Mars. And if the moon comes in as an interim step, well, all well and good. But we need to know that we want to go to Mars, and Mars needs to be in all the computations and all of the plans. And saying that we're just going to go to the moon and then maybe we'll get to Mars someday seems to me kind of weeny.
Kind of weenie. Pat, we've got it. Let's go to New York City and Brenda. Brenda, what do you say?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
To me, this is one more example of the insanity of man. Right now, we're witnessing the sixth great extinction. And by 2050, a quarter of all mammals will have gone extinct. And humans are responsible for this. And in addition, we're facing a crisis which could cause our own extinction, which is runaway global warming. The positive feedback loops are already starting. The melting Arctic is causing more melting Arctic.
Is that a reason not to go to the moon or Mars, Pat? Brenda, I mean, what do you think?
I say we need to put all of our resources into saving the only planet we know supports life, which is our own Earth.
Emergency all hands on deck on Earth. We'll pick that up again, Brenda, and thank you for your call. One more, Burlington, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I love the space program. A huge space enthusiast. I think to inspire the American public, either we can go to Mars, which I would love to do, but that would basically be for a visit and then come home safely. The other option is to go to the moon and colonize and stay at the moon and from now on out, always have a human presence on the moon, which I think would be additionally inspiring. I'd love to do both, but I think I think that staying close to home is probably going to be more doable, but I want it to be a permanent presence.
And what about Brenda in New York City's thought, stay close to home right now and fix the Earth before you mess around in space? We've got an emergency on the planet.
Well, I understand, but I think without the space program, we wouldn't even know the extent of the emergency. So I think that you get a lot of environmental knowledge, and learning how to exist in a closed habitat in space or how to have a recycling system that doesn't waste any water is probably useful scientific information when our resources are dwindling. So I totally feel what she's saying, and we are destroying this planet, but that's no reason for us to stick our head in the sand, and we need to keep exploring. That's human nature.
John, thanks for your call. David Kring, first to you. You heard our earlier caller in Vermont say just going back to the moon is kind of weeny. I'm not sure that's a scientific term, but what do you say?
Well, the first thing to understand is the Constellation program as designed and initially outlined by the former president is one that does take us to Mars. Every meeting when we talk about the infrastructure and the technology needed to be developed for sustainable operations on the lunar surface are done with an eye with Mars forward. And so Mars is part of the equation, but we realize that the technological hurdle needed to get there is substantial and want to make sure that we do it right on the moon. And the moon itself is, scientifically speaking, a wonderful and extraordinary place in its own right that will not only teach us about the moon, but teach us more about our own planet. One of your callers discussed the issue of extinctions. Well, one of the largest mass extinction events that occurred on Earth is the one that occurred 65 million years ago when dinosaurs were driven to extinction. Mm. And we now understand that was caused by an impacting asteroid because of the Apollo program to the lunar surface.
Robert Zubrin in Denver, we've got a lot on the table here. The moon, you don't want to go there first, but a lot of people have a sense of what that entails. Mars is kind of overwhelming. I wish you'd kind of lay out in very simple steps what it would mean to go to Mars. What kind of spaceship, how much time, what kind of commitment by the astronauts who would step up for that. Give us, first of all, just the rudimentaries of what it would require to go to Mars. And do you stay there once you get there or turn around and come back home after, you know, a few hours of romping?
Okay. The reason why you want to go to Mars is because Mars is the planet that has on it the resources needed to support life, which is what makes it scientifically interesting. We can find out whether there is or ever was life on another world and find out whether we're unique in the universe, but also because these very same resources that make Mars interesting also make it attainable. We can much more easily make things like rocket propellant and oxygen on Mars than we can on the moon, and we need to take advantage of that. Okay, when we go to Mars. So the way you do a Mars mission is like this. You need a heavy lift launch vehicle with about the same capability as the Saturn V moon rocket that we used during the Apollo program. Mm-hmm. But we do the mission with two launches. The first launch is to Mars, an Earth return vehicle with no one in it. And that flies out to Mars. It takes 8 months for it to get to Mars on a low-energy trajectory. It goes and it lands on Mars. And once it's on Mars, you run a pump and you suck in the Martian air, which is 95% carbon dioxide. And you react that carbon dioxide with a small amount of hydrogen that you bring from Earth to produce a large supply of methane and oxygen rocket propellant. This is 19th century chemical engineering. Mm-hmm. I've built automated systems that could do this in my lab, so have other people. So now you've got a fully fueled Earth return vehicle sitting, waiting for you on the Martian surface. Mm-hmm. Once that's done, at the next launch opportunity, you launch the crew out to Mars. And they fly out to Mars. You shoot them directly to Mars using the upper stage of this Saturn V equivalent. And NASA has designed a vehicle called the Ares V, which has similar capabilities.
8 months trip for them as well, 8 months out?
Well, you could probably get them there in 6 months. Okay. It doesn't take that much extra fuel to cut that transit to six. And then they fly out. And they go and land on Mars in the immediate vicinity of the Earth return vehicle. They use their transit hab as their house and laboratory on Mars. They operate on Mars, exploring the region for a year and a half to do a lot of field exploration, to look for life, to look for resources. And then at the end of that time, they get in the Earth return vehicle and they fly home. They leave their habitat behind on Mars. So each time you do this, you add another habitat to the base. And before you know it, you've created the beginning of the first human settlement on a new world. There is nothing in this that is beyond our technology. Compared to the technical challenge facing America in launching the moon program in 1961, this is like a factor of 10 easier.
But your ambitions beyond that are gigantic. You talk about terraforming, pumping hydrocarbons into the atmosphere of Mars, turning it into a kind of Earth-like planet in space.
That's for the future. Okay. Mm-hmm. In my book, The Case for Mars, I walk people through from our first exploration expeditions, which is the task for our era, okay, through establishing permanent bases, settlements, and eventually in the far future, people can terraform Mars. I think we'll do that because we're life and it's the nature of life to take barren environments and transform those into friendly for the development and propagation of life. That's the entire history of life on Earth. And no sooner does any barren place appear on Earth, like Hawaii coming out of the Pacific Ocean, this huge piece of bare, sterile basalt, birds fly over, they drop seeds, the place becomes lush, Polynesians show up and let loose pigs so there's something good to eat, Europeans show up and build hotels so there's a good place to check in. You know, this what we do. And it would be unnatural if humans is the kind of bird, as it were, that the biosphere has evolved that can fly across the interplanetary ocean and deposit the seeds of life on a currently barren island out there, that we wouldn't do it. So we'll do that someday. But that's not for our time. That's for the future. Our time is establish that first Plymouth Rock settlement on a new world, establish humanity's first foothold on a new world. From that, great things will come later.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point 40 years after the first moon launch. We're talking about moon versus Mars and where the United States should aim its next big manned exploration effort, asking which the U.S. might, should aim to colonize, moon or Mars. We've heard a lot from the moon on this 40th anniversary of the first mission there launch. The latest Mars exploration rover, the Opportunity Explorer rover, the Opportunity landed January 25th in 04. So we've got sound from around enthusiasm for Mars as well here in California. Scientists then at the National Jet Propulsion Lab eagerly awaited confirmation of that Mars landing.
The spacecraft is bouncing on the surface. It is difficult to maintain lock.
We're seeing it on the LCP. Very strong on LCP.
We have a very strong signal in the left-hand polarization channel indicating that
there.
We still have a stable.
We're getting a signal on RCP as well.
Here.
Both channels. We're on Mars, everybody.
Copy that. We have it.
We're on Mars, everybody. A different kind of party, a Mars party right there. Robert Zubrin is here, author of The Case for Mars. You know where he wants to go. David Kring is with us from Houston. He says, time to go back to the moon. Learn there before Mars. He's senior staff scientist at NASA's Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. Let's go to Columbia, South Carolina, and Wayne. Wayne, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
Mars.
Why?
The reason... I really am excited to say this. I think even the most positive of your guests and commentators are underestimating the effect that going to Mars successfully would have on every rational human being. I think the reason is because consider how many people go through their lives. You hear about it all the time with this sense of lack of purpose. This lack of a higher meaning. What is that higher meaning if our species is not reaching out and if someone is not taking those steps that are beyond even the everyday person's imagination?
Wayne, what about the fix Earth first message we heard earlier from New York?
I don't understand the dichotomy. You know, that's like saying you need to fix your house before you leave to go to work or something. You have to manage your life while you work on the next step. Of course we need to fix whatever problems we have, but it's at least irrational to say that we can't do anything else until we fix the Earth. Because that would be like saying you can't do anything in your life until you fix your psychology. You can't get married until you fix your personal psychology.
Wayne, we've got it. I hear that yearning for the inspiration. Let's go to Mars, you say. Let me get one more. Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay.
The moon has been part of my life since the day I was born, July 20th, 1969.
Literally the day of the landing. That's incredible.
It was great, and I've always, you know, dreamed of the moon. But my first memories are of the Viking landers in about 1975. And I want my five-year-old to be looking forward. We've done the moon. Let's go to Mars. It's time to go to Mars.
Go to Mars, you say. John, we've got it. And by the way, to celebrate that anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch, NASA has got out refurbished videos of the landing on your birthday, John. And if you want to see those, you can go to our website, link there. They're quite incredible. There's also a story about the accidental loss of the original tapes at onpointradio.org. David Kring, you hear this enthusiasm for Mars, and we're just kind of taking it as it comes here. What do you say to all those who say, you know, they want to be Martians first? Done moon.
I appreciate their interest. I myself have done a considerable amount of research. I've analyzed samples already from Mars. I've been a part of two Mars missions, and so part of my heart is with Mars too. But in looking at the nation's space program and trying to devise a path that is rational and sustainable and will grow the interest and the technological capability that is needed to create the economic engine in this nation that is needed to feed all of these projects, I think we have to go back to the moon first.
Now, how does a moon mission create the economic engine? Just the same way it did in the 60s? We have to rev up again on technology or something else?
Well, exactly. Apollo was a technological driver, which was in turn an economic driver. And in fact, largely due to Apollo, we as the United States citizens enjoy a wonderful quality of life. And that's the the reason, I think, behind the 2004 vision for space exploration that the previous president outlined. And going back to the moon is going to do that. I mean, the challenges in going back to the moon are immense. For example, one of the landing sites that's being discussed is on the rim of a small crater called Shackleton at the lunar south pole. This small crater is over 4 kilometers deep. Okay, that's 2 to 3 times deeper than the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
Trying to navigate that type of terrain on the lunar surface is itself going to be challenging, and that is going to teach us how to navigate the terrain anywhere, whether it be Mars or some other place in the solar system.
Does Mars have similar craters? It has an atmosphere. Maybe the asteroids break up a bit before they hit Mars.
The smaller ones do, but the southern hemisphere of Mars is intensely cratered, and in fact, this is one of the interesting twists. The moon is such a unique and of such high scientific value that we learn about Mars by going to the moon. We have already learned by studying and analyzing samples brought back from the moon by the Apollo missions that the southern highlands of Mars were probably produced in a cataclysmic bombardment about 4 billion years ago. Those types of secrets, those types of results can be extracted from our nearest neighbor, the moon.
Do you see moon eventually as a launch base, as our guest astronaut Schmidt does?
Yes, it can be, and as much spiritually and intellectually as well as in terms of its pure technology. I think that when people can walk out in their own backyard and look up at the moon and say that, look, there are people who are living there right now, living day in and day out.
And that's what you'd like to see, a permanent colony there?
Certainly a well-provisioned outpost doesn't need to have people there all the time, but what we do need to develop are the technologies and the capability to live there permanently.
Let's go to Lou in Buffalo, New York. Lou, you're on the air. What do you think?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I wanted to respond to Robert and a remark that he had made a little early on here in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a bit of a naive diatribe. He was talking about, you know, the high-tech engineers here and high-tech engineers there and how we were looking for any type of that we could to help get this man on the moon through the decade. And these types of engineers and that out there now are working in Walmarts, Tom. And I'll tell you what, they'd have been working in Walmarts back then, except for one thing. And no one's really touched on this. I'm old enough that I recall the intensity, the almost near firebrand where we got into nuclear confrontation. The backdrop of this was Holy Mother Russia. And the fact that through in the 100-yard dash, almost to the 90-meter mark, Russia was ahead. And it is because of that Cold War, that element, that we were drawing from every aspect that we could.
So you're saying we don't have the motivation now, Lou, but should we have the motivation now?
Well, I mean, I feel we should have motivation, but if it's not something political or arch rival like that, I'm afraid that the whiz kids coming out of college, you know, they're not going to bring them in and pay them an arm and a leg to help us to Mars.
Hey, let us pick it up, Robert Zubrin. Motivation then and now.
Well, we need to motivate ourselves. By the way, I'll say while there are plenty of people who got scientific educations because they were excited about Apollo. Didn't end up working in the space program. They ended up working in medicine. They ended up working in other fields of engineering. Not many of them are working in Walmart. An engineering education will keep your kid out of Walmart. But
Lou
so
says then we
I
have the Cold War and the Soviet Union breathing down the U.S. neck and all that.
Well, I would hope that we could go to Mars on the basis not of fear but of hope. On the basis of what we will get from going to Mars, on the basis of the scientific enlightenment of discovering whether life is unique to the Earth or a general phenomenon of the universe, and on the basis of the possibility that by going to Mars, we can find out whether human beings can settle another world. And this is an important point because some people who've spoken earlier today have contrasted a mission to Mars as a visit versus a colony on the moon. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. Mars has the resources needed for settlement. The moon does not. Mars has water. The moon has almost none. Mars has got carbon. The moon has none. Mars has nitrogen. The moon has none. This is fundamental for life. For the coming age of exploration, Mars compares to the moon as North America compared to Greenland in the previous age of exploration. Greenland was closer to Europe. Europeans mm-hmm. got there first, but it was not a place you could settle. It was too barren. The moon is too barren for settlement. Going to the moon is a sterile activity. Going to Mars offers the prospect of initiating new branches of human civilization.
Let's go to Brett in Spokane, Washington. Brett, you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to say go to the moon if it's an economically beneficial thing. And the area I'm wondering about, I've heard talk about developing power on the moon, either nuclear or solar. I wanted to ask, has anybody said anything about how we're going to get that power to Earth?
Let us pick it up, Brett. David Kring, I'm looking at this diagram of somehow microwaving solar energy from the moon to Earth. Is that a real possibility, Brett wonders?
I actually have to say I'm not expert enough in microwave technology to really evaluate that. I do know that there are two methods that have been discussed in returning energy to the Earth from the moon, one being the helium-3 fusion technology that Senator Schmidt outlined, mm-hmm. and the other one, the microwave beaming that you've just described. But the first thing that we have to do is learn how to, of course, develop power sources that work in that extraterrestrial environment, and that I think alone is going to be a little bit of a challenge. It will be a mix, I think, of solar power. It will be a mix of nuclear power, and learning how to operate under those conditions for long periods of time, not just 2 or 3 days, is itself going to be a technological challenge. Mm.
Robert Zubrin, what about resource returns from Mars to the Earth? Is there something that might be brought back in addition to, you say, settlement and life there?
Okay. First, I'd like to comment on the moon thing, and then I'll go on to Mars. Mm-hmm. The idea of microwaving solar power from the moon as an economical source of energy on the Earth is off the wall. Solar power is not even competitive on Earth with terrestrial power sources, and solar power on the moon would be about 1 million times more expensive than solar power on Earth. Furthermore, if anyone ever did build a giant solar power beamer system on the moon, it would be really a weapon of mass destruction, and I think that it would cause great concern to people all over the Earth that it could be used in that way.
Hmm.
The fusion fuel from the moon is interesting. I'll give Harrison Schmidt that. But what we really need to do there is put more effort into developing fusion reactors here on Earth, which that's a precondition to making use of any fusion fuel that comes from the moon or anywhere else. And I'd like to see the U.S. fusion research budget doubled or tripled. Right now, it's a factor of 3 lower than what it was in 1980 in real dollars.
What might we bring home from Mars, if anything?
Inventions. Okay. The same thing that Europe actually got out of America. You create a frontier culture of technologically adept people in a frontier environment where they're both free to innovate and forced to innovate by new circumstances. And you'll come up with all kinds of things. I mean, you know, much better than cotton or some other product that Europeans got from America, they got electricity and telephones and aeroplanes and democracy and all kinds of things that a new culture created. And Mars has a chance of being a new branch of human civilization. So, for instance, on Mars, while you have the resources to grow plants, which you don't have on the moon, you've got carbon dioxide and water, but you'd have to grow them in greenhouses, okay? So you'll want to develop very advanced plant strains that can make use of every square meter for maximum productivity.
That we might bring home from Mars. I apologize, but I have so many callers. Let me get one more here from Atlanta, Georgia. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm really enjoying this discussion. I'm definitely pro-Mars, while I think the moon is important, but I have more of a philosophical question regarding our political atmosphere. If we have China, Russia, America, any other developed nation looking for colonizing on the moon or Mars or wherever, are we at a point where we can realistically cohabitate, or do we run a risk of really turning into another colonial based, like, you know, the old British Empire colony is like, oh, this is the American colony, the Chinese colony, fighting over territory on these new planets.
So we can have French and Indian wars or Martian wars. Robert Zubrin, how about it? How do you share if you settle long term? You know exactly what Anthony's talking about. Look at the history of this planet.
Well, Mars has got a surface area equal to all the continents of the Earth put together. So there's room on Mars for more than one flag. And if we can find a way to be peaceful on Earth, we'll certainly find a way to be peaceful on Mars.
What's your date, your target date, if you'd like to be on Mars, I don't know, with people colonizing Mars? By when?
Okay. The technical challenges today, there are technical challenges in going to Mars, but they're an order of magnitude lower than those were to going to the moon in 1961. If Barack Obama was to get up next week and commit this nation to go to Mars with the same vigor that Kennedy committed us to go to the moon, we could be on Mars by the end of his second term, and that's what we ought to do. Be on Mars by 2016.
David Crane, if it's the moon first and then Mars, what dates would you put on those? First moon, then Mars.
Well, I think we already have established a schedule for returning to the moon, and that's 2020. Beyond that, getting to the Mars, I don't know that we can evaluate that until we go through the technological development for establishing long-term presence on the lunar surface.
Do you think Robert Zubrin is too optimistic? If we decided to, if Barack Obama said, let's do it, Mars 2016?
I do think that that's probably too optimistic. I think that we don't have the technological capability to do that, and I worry that we don't have the financial wherewithal. I mean, one of the things that separates Apollo from today's environment is Apollo, because of the Cold War, was supported with 4.5% of our GDP, NASA now is less than 1% by a lot.
Well, it's been a really interesting hour. We'll see where the rockets fly ultimately, but a great conversation to have on the 40th anniversary of the launch for the moon. David Kring with NASA's Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Robert Zubrin, he's head of Pioneer Astronautics and author of The Case for Mars and How to Live on Mars. Robert Zubrin, thank you very much for joining us from Denver.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us as well. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.